Good afternoon. Welcome to the National Press Club. My name is Gil Klein. I'm the club's president and a national correspondent with Media General Newspapers, writing for the Richmond Times-Dispatch, the Tampa Tribune, and the Winston-Salem Journal. I'd like to welcome my fellow club members in the audience today and their guests, as well as those of you who are watching us on C-SPAN or listening to us on National Public Radio or the Internet Global Computer Network. Before introducing our head table, I'd like to remind our members of some upcoming events. On Thursday, June 30th, which is tomorrow, actor and author Kirk Douglas will talk about the narrowing gap between fact and fiction in both the movies and the news media in a speech entitled Make Believe Versus Reality. On Tuesday, July 12th, Timothy Wirth, the Undersecretary of State for Global Affairs, will help us present the National Press Club Robert L. Kozik Environmental Reporting Awards and discuss global commitments to environmental protection. And on Wednesday, July 13th, Bud Selig, Chairman of the Major League Baseball Executive Committee, will discuss the pending strike. Audio and videotapes of Press Club lunches are available by calling 1-800-500-9911. If you have any questions for our speaker, and I certainly trust that you will, please write them on the cards provided for you at your tables and pass them forward, and I will ask as many as time permits. I'd like now to introduce the head table and ask each one to stand briefly when his or her name is called. From your right is John Broder, White House correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. Robert Rankin, White House correspondent for Knight Ridder Newspapers. Stan Kroc, news editor of Business Week. Jane Fullerton, Washington correspondent for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette. Helen Thomas, chief White House correspondent for United Press International. Robert Mary, executive editor of Congressional Quarterly. Donna McLarty, the wife of our speaker.
She deserves a little applause. She's put up with us.
Skipping over our speaker for the moment is Mary Crowley, executive editor of Business Publishers Incorporated and vice chairwoman of the National Press Club Speakers Committee. Mark Guerin, White House communications director. Peggy Roberson, national desk editor of Hearst Newspapers and the member of the Speakers Committee who organized today's lunch. Julia Malone, White House correspondent for Cox Newspapers. John Cochran, congressional correspondent for ABC News. And finally, Craig Hines, Washington bureau chief for the Houston Chronicle. Also, I'd like to thank staff members Melissa Bender, Sherry Burton, Melanie Abdow-Dermott, and Jeff Tarbell for organizing today's luncheon. Now, today we are pleased to have with us Mr. Mac McLarty, who until Monday was President Clinton's chief of staff, and after July 11th will have the title of counselor to the president. He worked at the White House and picked up today's Washington Post. I think I would have skipped the front page and turned right to the comics. The news was not good for the president. Healthcare legislation in trouble in the House, a legal defense fund needed to defend the president, Haitian refugees overwhelming the Coast Guard's ability to process them. I would think all of them would want to see how Blondie and Dagwood were doing. At the center of this storm is Mac McLarty. Many of the administration officials who have spoken here this year have one thing in common. They met Bill Clinton early in their lives, in college or law school or during the McGovern campaign, developed a friendship, and joined his band of loyal followers. Mr. McLarty is the granddaddy of this band. He and Bill Clinton go back to kindergarten in a town called Hope. Mr. McLarty not only is the president's best friend, he has also had a successful career of his own, first as student body president at the University of Arkansas, and then as one of the youngest people elected to the Arkansas House of Representatives. Mr. McLarty was precocious in business as well. as politics, becoming the youngest person ever elected to the board of directors of the Arkansas Louisiana Gas Company. He rose to become chairman of the board and chief executive officer. In addition, he helped transform a family business, McLarty Companies, into one of the South's largest transportation companies. So it was reasonable for the president to turn to a confidant, politician, and businessman to be his chief of staff, even if he lacked Washington experience. While he took pride in the administration's accomplishments during its first year, Mr. McLarty saw, as he said himself, that 1994 is different. He initiated the changes that brought in Leon Panetta as chief of staff. He recognized it was time to give the job to a Washington insider. Mr. McLarty will continue to use his affable style to shore up support for Mr. Clinton among Democrats and businessmen. When asked if Mr. McLarty is on his way out, the president laughed and said emphatically, "He isn't going anywhere. He's my closest friend." So, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in a warm press club welcome for Mr. Mac McLarty.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Gail, thank you very much for a vintage National Press Club introduction. Distinguished members of the head table and ladies and gentlemen of the National Press Club. First, let me thank you for your warm reception as Donna and I entered the room. We appreciate it very much. We are delighted to be here and particularly to see many familiar faces and good friends and people that we look forward to working with and respect and admire very much. As Gil noted, many of you probably were aware that I got a new job this week. And I must admit to you that I was perhaps hoping that this new assignment might get me out of this speech. I gave it serious thought. And there were moments when I was not sure whether I should come or not. But after several hours of long meetings with our consultants, with members of the economic team in the Roosevelt Room, certainly with Alan Greenspan, I thought it was a wise decision to come, and here I am. As Gil noted, I am getting ready to move closer to the president, but I wanted Leon Panetta to know that I'll be leaving a few things behind for him. Like this new book that just came out, some of you may have heard of it, it's called The Agenda. Now, I want you to know that I have nothing against this Woodward fella at all. In fact, I called him after Monday's announcement and said, "Bob, I know that you have worked hard and done your best, but I'm afraid with all the shuffle and all that we're going to have to let you go as White House stenographer." It really saddened me to convey that news, but you know, in politics, even nice guys have to make tough decisions. Leon Panetta is one of the ablest and funniest and most likable people that I have ever met. And I certainly want to do everything that I can to help him avoid getting the tag of a nice person. So there's another book that I really believe it's appropriate for me to leave with Leon. And I think what this White House really needs is a chief of staff who can read Machiavelli in the original Italian. That's from a small segment, I think. Let me take on a bit more serious note an opportunity to thank the president for the grace and the leadership that he has shown to me and to Donna, and most importantly to this country over the past 18 months. I do, in all seriousness, want to congratulate the person that is taking my place, Leon Panetta. I obviously think the president made a splendid choice, and I am truly looking forward to my new position as I believe we will be fielding a very strong team. I do have a very serious purpose in coming here today, and I wanted to visit with you for a few moments about why I came to Washington and what I hope to do for this president, and most importantly, what is at stake for our country in the crucial months ahead. I didn't, despite Gil's warm introduction, come to Washington because I had a friend I had known from kindergarten that ended up as president and offered me a chance to work 80 hours a week at about a 90% cut in pay. I helped my friend Bill Clinton get elected and came with him to Washington when he asked me to do so, because Donna and I have two sons with a stake, a real stake, in this country's future. And I simply did not want to sit back, afforded that opportunity, and let this nation going the way that it had been headed. As Gil noted, I came here as a businessman, as a father, and as an American who was fortunate enough to grow up in a small town with strong values, in a country with high hopes and big dreams, and who wants those values and dreams to still be around for the next generation. Now, I was drawn to Bill Clinton's presidency not only because of our long-standing friendship, but because I thought he had what had been lacking to a large degree for the last decade or two: the strategy and the values and the vision to turn this country in a different direction, to pull our people together, to move it in a different direction in clearly a period where fundamental and profound change was taking place. He came into office with a very comprehensive, cohesive plan, a roadmap, if you will, for renewal, a plan to revive our economy, putting people first, and repair our social fabric. And as a business person, as I examined it in considerable detail, as you would expect, I felt it all fitted together in a comprehensive, a cohesive way, but also in a visionary way. It all fits together, and really, no matter what comes his way, the president, as Jane knows, with real Virginia Kelly spirit, frankly gets up every morning, works every day to keep us moving forward. And I believe that's the kind of leadership that this country has been yearning for a good number of years. Now, as Gil noted, as a third generation in a substantial family business and having the opportunity to serve as chairman of a Fortune 500 company in the 1980s, I could sense, as many Americans could sense, that this nation was drifting in the face of tremendous change and tremendous opportunity. And Bill Clinton came along with a vision to give hardworking Americans a chance to get ahead again in a vastly changing world. And he understands to do that, that we've also got to connect with the values that have served us so well in the past, work and responsibility and faith and family, with the new world that we're entering. We've got to make that connection. Our work obviously began with making some very important and, in most cases, difficult decisions. that, frankly, others could not or would not make. It was imperative to get our house in order. That was a fundamental first step that had to be taken and had to be achieved. We did make real cuts of about $250 billion in spending. We are now on track well below CBO estimates to reduce the deficit for three straight years, and that is the first time that trend line has occurred since Harry Truman was president. We are going to cut the federal bureaucracy by at least 250,000 people, mostly by attrition. And that will be the lowest level of federal employment since John Kennedy was president. We are cutting taxes for 15 million working families in the bargain, and yet we still found room to make key investments, crucial investments, in infrastructure, research, technology, and education. Critical investments for the future. Now, I would respectfully submit to this distinguished group that it frankly took considerable political courage for Bill Clinton to risk his young presidency on a rather bold plan to slay the deficit dragon. He frankly could have aimed lower and done less. But Bill Clinton firmly believed, and I strongly supported him and counseled him in that belief, that we would never be able to really tackle our economic and social problems if we did not have the character to tackle the fundamental challenge of getting our house in order. And I can tell you very candidly that he's thought about this and he studied this for years. We have run a very disciplined budget process, probably the most disciplined ever. I think that reflects well on the President and the White House, but it certainly proves that our new Chief of Staff, Leon Panetta, is a success before he even gets started. The results are encouraging, and I think to a large degree speak for themselves. Our economic policies have helped, and I underline helped, spur the fastest pace of growth in business investment since 1972. Core inflation, a key number for those in the private sector last year, was the lowest since price controls were in place under President Richard Nixon. Consumer confidence is high, increasing just yesterday. Car and truck sales are up almost enough to make me yearn to be an active Ford dealer again. And in the first quarter of this year, there was not a single bank failure in this country, not one. Most importantly, lower interest rates and increased investment have, frankly, fueled a rather strong and measurable economic recovery, creating about 3.5 million jobs over the last 18 months, about 90% of them in the private sector. And I really don't say this in an inappropriate way to take credit. It was the private sector, ladies and gentlemen, not the government, that created the jobs and sold the cars and trucks, invested in training, invested in new plant and equipment. This recovery belongs to the working men and women of this country, to the business community and the entrepreneurs in America, not the politicians. I would say that our policies have created a certainty in the economic landscape, which is crucial for economic recovery and growth, and particularly investment. It did point the way to this recovery. It provided the foundation and the support, and it frankly reflects the character and the leadership of Bill Clinton. As we put our economic house in order at home, President Clinton believed that we also must reach out and expand our economic horizons around the world. Our older son, Mark, who was a sophomore at Georgetown when Donna and I moved to Washington, is now on a exchange program in Hong Kong, and he called recently, and of course that's a very growing region of the world, and he said, "Dad, you do understand the world is getting closer together, don't you? You do get it, don't you?" I assured him I did. Bill Clinton understands it's essential to build markets. And that's what he's attempted to do in a very disciplined way, even when it frankly meant going against some of the supporters that helped get us here. The NAFTA debate really proved to be a defining moment for this administration and the country. Three times during that deliberation as Chief of Staff, I went to Bill Clinton and said, "Mr. President, we're at a crossroads. Are you sure you want to go forward with the NAFTA legislation?" There were plenty of occasions when he frankly could have backed out rather gracefully. He certainly was aware, as I was, that we might possibly lose this important vote. A few of you wrote that we might indeed lose it by a substantial margin. And it was certain that it would be divisive in our party. But every time, after reflection and thought, he made a decision to move forward because he felt it was the right thing to do. NAFTA and GATT and our other trade initiatives are a central part of that economic vision that I spoke of. Simply stated, we really must trust in our American workers and expand trade and not retreat from the world. And we must give those workers the security they need to make the most of it. We owe our working men and women a chance to educate themselves for a lifetime and a retraining system that is based on reemployment and not unemployment. And finally, if we're going to put our whole house in order and really succeed in this changed world, the President believes, as I do, that we must restore the values here at home that have always made America strong: work and faith and family and responsibility, and a sense of community. We will never make government work satisfactorily again and regain the real faith of our people or repair our social fabric unless we put those values back at the center of everything that we do. Those values are really why the current deliberations over health reform is so important. As a businessman, I certainly understand the urgency of health care reform. Our companies are competing in the world marketplace against competitors that are paying about half as much. But I understand the emotional cost as well. Like millions of Americans in this country, my mother is battling cancer, and we must live with that reality and that fear and that pain every day. And I frankly cannot imagine what it must be like to go through a similar situation for the hundreds of thousands of families who are uninsured. The President could have backed away from his promise a long time ago and cut a deal that gives up universal coverage. But some things are worth pushing forward and fighting for. And he's going to keep fighting for a health care plan that's real reform, that's not a victory of narrow interest, but a victory for the hardworking middle class of this country. The values that I'm speaking of and really go to the President's commitment to the Brady Bill and assault weapons that were passed in Congress, and the ability to move forward on a crime bill that will put 100,000 policemen on our streets. It frankly was not easy or particularly pleasant standing up to the NRA and defeating them twice, and taking the heat from the left and the right for pushing crime-fighting measures that have spent most of this decade in gridlock. But I think you would agree that there is no more right worth fighting for than every American's right to feel safe. One of the ways I hope I can help the president in my new role as counselor is for the two of us to keep grounded in those values that I spoke of. The Bill Clinton that I see every day and have known for 40 years, as Gil noted, is a person of courage and deep roots and strong conviction. In the face of adversity and against pretty considerable odds, he has kept moving forward. And that's really the essence of leadership in many ways. Lesser people, frankly, might have walked away. And in the end, I believe he will be rewarded for it, because this is a country that has always been willing to take a deep breath, rise to the challenge, and summon the courage to change in a thoughtful way. And when we do that, I hope we can all do it together. Because the challenges we face are not Republican or Democratic problems. They are American problems, and we really need to solve them together. I've been a Democrat all of my life. At one time, had the privilege to serve as chairman of our state Democratic Party under then Governor David Pryor, and on the national committee with the inimitable Bob Strauss as chairman. I ran for office as a Democrat, and someday perhaps I may do so again. Now, Donna, don't panic. Someday is flexible enough that even Helen Thomas can't nail me down on that. But she'll try. But I've always had plenty of Republican friends, and I have honestly tried to set party labels aside to get things done. And that's the way Bill Clinton has approached the situation as well. And if that works for the rest of America, perhaps we ought to try harder to make it work here. Today we have the most centrist president in memory, trying to go beyond the politics of both parties and reaching out to offer both sides a chance to break gridlock on issues of paramount importance. We have a country confronted with great challenges and opportunities, and frankly, many in this country have lost some faith in political parties and certainly care less and less about partisan labels and more about getting things done. And yet we have a political culture that from time to time seems to reward whichever party gets up from the table and walks away. Now, I know there are many Republicans who have worked on health care for many years and understand this complex issue very well, and that want to pass a meaningful, a comprehensive health reform bill. I know there are Republicans who worked closely with us and appreciate what was done on NAFTA. I know there are Republicans who want to support a real crime bill and the GATT round and welfare reform, and we look forward to those discussions and debate. I know there are Republicans who don't want to go home and face voters and good friends without getting something done. So I really want to say to good friends in both parties, we've all made some mistakes. There's plenty of blame to go around. But we have no right to waste this urgent moment in history. We can't sit back and watch our businesses and government spend $1 trillion a year on health care while millions of middle-class American families don't get adequate coverage or any coverage at all. We simply can't wait another generation, in my opinion, to reform a welfare system when already more than a third of the babies in this country are born where there is no marriage. We shouldn't wait another minute to pass a crime bill when teenagers are shooting at each other and roaming the streets with almost weapons of war and better armed than police. Ladies and gentlemen, what's really at stake in this debate is not who's up and who's down and who's the best positioned. What's at stake are the values that brought us here and the vision that will lead us forward. What's at stake is the sense of community that Bill Clinton and I grew up with in Hope and Hot Springs, and I suspect many of you grew up with in similar upbringings. It seemed to me at that time there was less of them and us and much more that we're all in this together. That's what we've lost some measure of, at least in my judgment. And whether we get anywhere as a nation depends on whether or not we will do what it takes to get that kind of sense of community back. This is a critical moment, and I hope we do not lose it. I recall those bus trips with Bill and Hillary Clinton and Al and Tipper Gore as they took trips across our country in 1992 when folks lined the roads for miles and at times used sparklers and their hopes and dreams to light the way. And our administration feels perhaps a special responsibility in that regard. To succeed, we must not only do what we set out to do, but after lifting hopes and getting people to believe again in the possibility of thoughtful change, we must also make certain that politics does not break their hearts once more. Stephen Bailey writes in The Ethics of Public Service that there are three essential moral qualities of public service: optimism, courage, and fairness tempered by charity. I agree. Optimism that we can have a good life for ourselves and a better life for our children and grandchildren. The courage to change and maximize one's strengths. And the fairness to treat all fellow human beings, even when we disagree, with dignity and respect. It's in that spirit that I genuinely appreciate your having me, and I look forward to working with you in the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. McLarty. We have a lot of questions here. And always take a few more. I can see them coming up. They're faster and faster. First one, this questioner says that many people believe that every president needs a person who can walk into the Oval Office and say, "You are really screwing up." The question is, can you do that? And will Leon Panetta be able to do that? And if Leon Panetta can't do it, will that still be your job?
The answer is yes to both. And I really mean that not in a flip way. I've been asked essentially that same question before, and that was understanding, in fact, one of the principal points that the president made during the transition when he asked me to take on the role of chief of staff. That has never been difficult to do for me, and I have never found the president defensive, reactive, or not receiving that kind of counsel in the right way. From time to time, he might see it a bit differently, Gil, but that has just simply never been a problem. It will not be a problem for Leon because he essentially has had to do the same type of thing, perhaps not in his personal way, as the question suggested, but on the budget and other OMB matters that obviously present Hobson's choices rather frequently.
Some reports say that it's difficult to be chief of staff in this White House because the First Lady and the Vice President have their own power centers, and that there are a number of counselors who are also are independent. Do you think this is true? And as a new counselor, will then you be part of the problem?
Now, Gail, you ad-libbed on the last part of that question. Well, I think those of you who have been in Washington and followed White Houses, and many of you have, would probably unanimously agree that the chief of staff role is a difficult position. Every former chief of staff or anyone that worked in a White House would, I believe, characterize it that way. It's a multifaceted job. It has frankly changed over the years a great deal in terms of not only the expectations, but the profile of the job has changed a great deal from the Sherman Adams days and Eisenhower, and even when Dick Cheney was chief of staff for President Ford. So I don't think anyone would dispute it's a difficult job. It is perhaps somewhat more difficult and complex, although that may be from one's perspective, when you have a very full legislative agenda and are really trying to achieve thoughtful change in the beginning term of a presidency, and that's what the majority of this people voted for, almost 60%. If you refer to the power centers, I honestly feel that we have done a very good job. I won't put it on a relative basis, but a very good job. And I think Mark Guerin, who traveled with the Vice President during the campaign, can not just verify, but perhaps provide insight to it and affirmation of integrating the Vice President's office in the White House. And I might say that also goes for the OMB office. In other White Houses, from time to time, they were fairly disparate, separate, and distinct. And I have used the Vice President's staff, as many of my staff members know, on many occasions to be helpful and supportive to me, and they've been unfailing in that regard. In terms of the First Lady, I had had, first of all, the opportunity, as Donna has, to know Hillary for 20 years plus, and had frankly, on many occasions, worked much more closely with her than I did the governor of Arkansas, simply because of corporate boardships and other endeavors. Donna and Hillary had been engaged in a campaign in juvenile justice that did not seem to have much of a chance and proved to be a winning endeavor. So I think Hillary was a wonderful and strong partner, an effective partner, as again Jane Fullerton knows, in Arkansas. And I think without her leadership, we simply would not be at this point, despite the headline you read, Gil, on health care, where we've really seen a historic moment of passing health care legislation out of two committees. It's the first time I believe that's happened, and obviously the debate is very active. So I view those people and those offices as value added and resources to this administration in this country.
Now, when you came in as chief of staff from a business background, it was said that you would bring business principles to government, and that has, of course, been said many times during the Bush and Reagan administrations. Now that you've had a look at it, do you think it's even possible to bring business principles to government?
Well, the private sector and the public sector are different. I've talked to a number of people who served in Arkansas with Governor Clinton from the private sector, and they would cite those differences. So I think it's fair first to state that up front. But I think that there are many principles or approaches to how you manage an organization, how you get things done, frankly, how you reach an agreement. That was one story, I think, indicative of that. I had not known George Mitchell that well, although I'd known many members of Congress, but not George particularly well, and we were working on the budget, working through some thorny issues, and George kind of grinned as he would add up these numbers on the budget, and I said, George, you're going to add up the same way every time, and we were trying to cuts and spending ratios. But reaching an agreement, Gil, on the budget is not frankly too different than trying to get an agreement in the private sector. Really some of the approaches, skills are very much the same. It certainly was a good reference for me. I think in a public company, particularly in this day and time, we were talking, Mary and I were talking about newsletters and other forms of communications, that has almost become a public arena and almost a political arena. And my background in the natural gas business with 11 regulatory commissions in 11 different states gives you some experience that's at least a quasi-public political sector. So I think some of the techniques, approaches, there are clearly differences, but there are a lot of similarities.
This question would like to know, at what point will the president define what is an acceptable compromise on universal coverage? Or to put it another way, when should he give his bottom line definition of universal coverage? Should he wait until floor debate is underway in the House and Senate?
Well, it sounds like someone would like to be part of our legislative strategy group and may have some good thoughts about that. I think right now, we believe the Ways and Means will report out favorably this week. Chairman Gibbons has done a superb job in that regard. The Senate Finance Committee under Chairman Moynihan, I think, will go forward with a hard trigger and a universal coverage approach. So I think we're at a very critical time in the health care debate, and I think that's as anticipated as when certain decision points will be reached, Gil. I think that's really speculative. But what I would say in terms of universal coverage, as I've looked at it, and Leon gave a very thoughtful speech last week, there is a direct link, obviously, between universal coverage and getting the revenues in the system and cost containment. And when I talked about this budget deficit, it's not some abstract statistical number out there that Bob Reichauer talks about. It is really the financial underpinnings of this country. And without that, not to sermonize, as our younger son might suggest I'm beginning to do, we will not be able to make the needed investments in terms of the social fabric. My point is, without health care reform, we are not going to be able to keep this deficit moving in the right direction. So I think those will be where the debate lines will be drawn. I think the polls I have seen, while there is some anxiety about any change, particularly as it relates to one's health care, I believe as this subject gets more and more debated, clearly people in this country believe universal coverage is the right thing to do from a social standpoint and believe it's achievable. And I am very much like the president, after traveling on this recent trip, why other developed countries are able to do that and provide universal coverage with quality care at a considerable lesser cost than ours. It just does not quite stand up to the litmus test that we can't achieve the same. And I think finally, Gil, it will become more and more apparent that we will be building on the system that in many ways has served us so well. So I'm hopeful at where we are right now in the health care debate. I'm not going to speculate on potential decision points.
A lot of questions about the falling dollar, like why does the dollar keep falling? This person says, some commentators and economic analysts suggest the falling dollar signals that this administration is heading down the road of Carter-type stagflation. Do you exclude this as a possibility, and how do you see the dollar's decline? If you like, you can call Alan Greenspan. I got a phone here.
Well, I think I'd rather call Secretary Benson on this. I think that's who is our principal spokesman and a very able spokesman on those kind of issues. Lloyd has stated very clearly that a weak dollar is not a part of our United States economic or trade policy, and that we are clearly committed to a strong dollar. I think in terms of currency exchanges, that's all that needs to be, frankly, said, other than from the Secretary of the Treasury or the President. In terms of any going down a particular road, I would hope that my comments, which are, I think, absolutely accurate in terms of core inflation, this is the lowest core inflation we've had in 20 years. It's a place where the private sector, many of whom you work with and represent every day, can get real returns on investment. So I see it just the opposite, particularly with a GDP number that came out at 3.4%. And perhaps most importantly, for the first time in many, many years, wages are outpacing inflation. So there is real growth of income in middle-class families. And I suspect that's why some of our automobile sales are up.
With the congressional hearing on Whitewater scheduled to begin next week, do you think this is going to slow down the administration? And Will this impede the ongoing criminal investigation being conducted by Special Counsel Fisk?
No, it won't. I think most administrations have had to deal with some matter of this type in recent history. And I believe one of the things we've done reasonably well is got a very good team that deals with this issue in a very professional and responsive way. And, of course, Lloyd Cutler is a sage White House counsel and will be responsible for the congressional hearings. John Podesta has really been the point person in terms of the assimilation of data and so forth. I think we've hopefully proven ability with the assault weapons ban, moving the crime bill forward, certainly keeping the health care process going, which is a formidable effort, that we frankly have good people in place to do this, and we'll be certainly open and forthright with the special counsel and the congressional hearings later in July.
This questioner says Congress is becoming increasingly uncomfortable with the so-called racial justice amendment of the crime bill on the view that it would strike an ambush blow to capital punishment. Is the White House prepared to accept the dropping of this provision, even if it angers the Congressional Black Caucus?
Well, you can tell that's from a journalist. There are certainly some phrases there used that make the question a pointed one. I met yesterday with Attorney General Reno, who has been fully engaged on the crime bill. Ron Klain, who had been at the White House and now is at the Department of Justice, has really been the primary person involved in this very important piece of legislation. George Stephanopoulos and I met with Pat Griffin with the members of the Black Caucus and the House leadership several days ago, as many of you know. General Reno will really, I think now that legal issues have become much more developed and sharpened, and she will be working in a very specific way with members of the Black Caucus and other groups concerning the racial justice clause, and I'm very hopeful that a full agreement can be reached. I might say that the mayors of this country are just so vitally interested in this legislation, and it is very thoughtful legislation in terms of it is properly balanced between the punishment side, getting community policemen on the street. You can see in Houston what that's done, and also with the prevention piece. And mayors of this country, I talked to Dennis Archer last week, who's been a longtime supporter and good friend of Bill Clinton's, and is a very able, outstanding mayor of Detroit. And you just hear what Dennis said over and over again about the critical importance of getting this crime bill passed. So I think that will provide a real impetus, not to just members of the Black Caucus, but to the Congress.
This questioner notes that in Bob Woodward's book, Agenda, David Gergen says he can't understand why the White House staff treats moderate Democrats like Senator Boren, who go against them, as traitors, while accepts liberals who oppose the White House, like Representative Bonnier, with open arms. Why is that?
Well, I'm always reluctant to speak for David Gergen. I think that might have been an interpretation. I don't know if there's a direct attribution or quote. David Gergen has enjoyed a longstanding relationship with David Boren, as I have, and President Clinton has, when they both served as governors. I think Bill Clinton is obviously a consensus builder, and I think that goes right to my remarks that we need to move this country forward, and we need to do it together. So I would not draw any distinctions, Gil, of that sort.
I'm just curious about this book, Agenda. Why would so many White House staff people speak so glibly to Bob Woodward when it came out so damaging, appearing to be so damaging?
Now, Gil, is that your question or one from the audience?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know about individual members of the White House. I think, as we saw from a number of books that have been written about various White Houses that have come out recently, and I won't get into any specifics because I'm not a critique of those type of books, but a critic or an advocate, that it seems that's somewhat, it just seems to occur as journalists and authors put their story together. I think what really is at the bottom, however, if you really look at The book itself is the economic plan, and I frankly think what it shows is a very engaged president who has thought about these issues for a long, long time, understood them very well as a governor, had a vision and a plan that I spoke of that all fitted together, heard all points of view with debate and discussion. I was there, and if that was contentious debate, I must not be quite as nice as everybody thinks, because I thought it was very constructive and helpful. And in the end, the president, I think, reached the right balance and decision. And I think you also need to perhaps note that the economic plan was over almost a year's period, about 9 months. That is a long time to really push forward on legislation through the House and the Senate. And that's why 5 of the last 6 budgets have literally been dead on arrival. And without getting that plan in place and without getting that foundation piece in place, I believe we would still be slipping and sliding around and not proceeding forward with crucial matters like health care reform and welfare reform and the crime bill.
This question notes that yesterday President Aristide of Haiti addressed the National Press Club and described Haiti as a house on fire. In view of the urgency of the Haitian problem and the recent flood of Haitian refugees, what can you tell us about the seriousness of U.S. military contingency plans to remove General Cedras and the military rulers in Haiti?
Well, first of all, the Haiti situation is clearly a deeply concerning situation from a human standpoint. And that needs to be put right at the feet of the military dictators that are running that country for a very small group of selfish people. Our goal, and we are committed to it, is to restore democracy there and to return the democratically elected leader who received over 70% of the popular vote. It was a democratic election by outside standards and verification. I'm not going to comment on any options or alternatives to do that. I think the president is on record that he is going to keep all of his options open, and I think that's as it should be. I would say that Special Envoy Gray, whom Don and I have known for a number of years, has added a real energy to that process. And I think the sanctions clearly are beginning to bite and bite hard, and I think we will be doing some more things regarding those sanctions in the next several days. We also are stepping up humanitarian aid in a dramatic way, as we should. So I think that's the current situation with our foreign policy team and with Bill Gray, whom I talked with a couple of days ago. The processing centers at Grand Turks and at Jamaica give us good flexibility, but the situation is a very, very serious one. But let's not forget where the responsibility of that situation really rests.
This questioner says, you talked about the Clinton administration's successes in cutting the deficit, cutting the number of federal employees, and cutting taxes. With so much to brag about, why are Democratic members of Congress so nervous about the president's political coattails in the upcoming November elections?
Well, I attempted to do it not in a bragging way, but whoever had the question, they listened carefully to my comments, which I appreciate very much. I think in terms of the upcoming congressional elections, we have seen that in prior races, people who ran with the president and talked about the record that I just outlined have fared quite well. I mentioned Houston in terms of the crime bill, where Mayor Lanier has been a good friend of the president's, has run with Bill Clinton in that regard. So I think that's really part of the message that has come out of some of the earlier elections, Gil. I think you do see a political landscape, as many of you have written about, that is an uneven landscape, an unusual landscape. People have, a mixture of a real hope, but at the same time, a healthy dose of skepticism that from time to time may go into cynicism. And I think that's what incumbents are going to face as they go home. But what my experience has been, not to comment on it too long, but generally voters very much look at an individual race. I mean, even when you had people like Dale Bumpers and David Pryor endorsing the same candidate, I mean, people really look at the individual race and the individual candidates. But I would just go back to there's just no question, particularly if we can move forward, and that is really the key issue, with critical legislation, not just to get legislation passed, but to do things that connect with people's lives. And what people want is, as that young man held up a sign in New York, just do something. And they want to get a crime bill passed that puts policemen on the street. They want to get welfare reform started to couple with the earned income tax credit, and they want to get health care reform done. That's what an incumbent, if I were incumbent, that's what I'd be running on.
I've got the signal that we are about out of time. I'm sure you wanted to stand up here and answer a lot more questions, didn't you? Before asking the last questions.
No comment.
I'd like to present you with that certificate of appreciation for being here.
Thank you.
And a National Press Club mug.
Thank you.
And a request that you tell the president we would be pleased to have him here, too.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Fine. Thank
and
you.
The last question is, aren't you getting sick to death of the moniker Mac the Nice?
There are worse monikers to have. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Internet Town Hall, a production of the Internet Multicasting Service in association with the National Press Club. You may copy this file and change the encoding format, but may not resell the contents or make a derivative work. Support for the Internet Town Hall comes from Sun Microsystems and O'Reilly & Associates. Additional support is provided by HarperCollins and Persoft. Network connectivity is provided by UUNet Technologies and MFS DataNet. This is Carl Malamud for the Internet Multicasting Service, Town Crier to the Global Village.